This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. With the holiday season upon us, that means holiday gatherings. And if you happen to be hosting one of these gatherings, you might be focused on what food you're going to serve. But hey, what about the drinks? According to our next guest, you don't have to be a professional mixologist to make great holiday cocktails for your guests. Joining us now are Carrie Jones and John McCarthy. They're the wife and husband co-authors of the book, Be Your Own Bartender, a surefire guide to finding and making your perfect cocktail. Carrie and John, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Well, thank you both for joining us. Now, your book, Carrie, is full of cocktail recipes, but I love this. You've got this flowchart format to help us find the kind of drink we want, just ask us questions and keeps narrowing it down. How did you come up with that idea?
Well, John and I have been creating cocktails together for about 5 years now. We've had a cocktail column for Food & Wine magazine on their website, and so, you know, we're used to being creative in terms of cocktail recipes. But John is professionally a mixologist, and all the time people at bars will ask him to come up with a cocktail for them on the spot. And so he always has a series of questions he asks. Do they want rum or bourbon or vodka, for example? And then, you know, do they want something a little lighter or a little boozier? And so we wanted to kind of replicate that experience, and the way we came up to do it was a flowchart.
And John, you are, as she said, a professional mixologist. I'd feel very comfortable having you make me a fancy drink. I'd feel less comfortable with me making me that fancy drink. Can we do this? Can we make great drinks at home?
You really can. We've kind of broken it down to make it as easy as possible. We have like charts and drinks for absolute beginners, but then, you know, we have drinks for people like myself that have, you know, total bartender cred. But the idea is that we don't want anybody to be intimidated. When you see cocktail books and it's just recipe after recipe and it's complicated, it almost feels like you're doing homework. So what we've tried to do here is just make it accessible and fun.
And one thing I like that you do, Carrie, is, you know, sometimes I look at a drink recipe and I think there's a obscure ingredient. I don't have it. I'm going to have to buy a whole bottle. I'm going to use like two shots of it and it'll sit there forever. When you come across those in your recipes, you say, hey, you can also use this in this other drink. That's an important part of how we stock our liquor cabinet, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was essential to us because even though we're very experienced with making cocktails, we also have the experience of, you know, getting a whole bottle of something and using half an ounce of it and seeing it sit there. So we really wanted to people when they discover ingredients they like within a cocktail to easily find other ways to use them too.
We've got a couple recipes that you've shared with us. They're on the Central Time page at WPR.org. John, we've got an alcoholic one, and then you designed a special non-alcoholic one for us. Let's start with the one from the book, The Dickory Dock, a big hit, you say, at your most recent holiday party. Tell us about this drink, John.
It's been received very well. We start off with a vodka base. We find that that is the most accessible party drink for people. And then we are using 100% cranberry juice. So not a cranberry cocktail. It's just straight cranberry juice. It's very tart, very dry. A little bit of lemon juice. And then we make a rosemary honey syrup. And that's not to get intimidated. Basically, you heat up water. You steep rosemary in it, and then you add honey. It's easy to make. And then we mix that all together, add a little club soda, and we have a party punch.
Yeah, and this one also had a little bit of bitters, orange bitters in this case. Carrie, can you talk about the value of having a couple kinds of bitters in our arsenal?
Absolutely. We sort of think of bitters the way you would think of spices in cooking or baking, that they just add the little extra nuance to a cocktail. And orange bitters we often like in drinks with fruit in them. It just gives them a different dimension and balances out all the other flavors. So if you do have a sweeter ingredient like the rosemary honey, the bitters can really balance it out.
Again, we've got that recipe at WPR.org. You can find it in the Central Time Zone there. John, how about, you know, it's winter here in Wisconsin. We come in, we're cold. What's a good couple of warm drinks we might consider making, especially for that holiday gathering?
One of the ones that we like, again, it's all about making it easy on yourself when you're having people over, is we have our hot cidered rum. Again, very easy to make. We're putting apple cider on the stove and heating it up, and then adding some dark rum to it and some maple syrup and, again, some Angostura bitters to add depth to the drink, and you can just serve it right off the stovetop.
That sounds great. And Carrie, do you have a favorite hot drink apart from that one?
Yeah, absolutely. What's another, John, what's another one of the of the hot drinks that we love? We have one called the Rum Diggity, which is sort of a rum old-fashioned, but that we serve hot. So just warm up dark rum and a little bit of hot water on the stovetop, and we pour it over a lemon slice, and just that little bit of citrus really gives it a nice lift. But it's a boozy cocktail, so it's not one you'll want a huge mug of, you know, small serving on this one.
That sounds
good. It's the one that you just came in from the snow, and you just need something really quick to warm you up, and that's the one, the Rum Diggity.
We're talking about holiday cocktails with Carrie Jones and John McCarthy. They're the co-authors of the new book, Be Your Own Bartender, a surefire guide to finding and making your perfect cocktail. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite cocktail to make and serve, maybe at a holiday gathering? Or are you looking for suggestions from our guests about how to make something or maybe something that'll go with the theme of your festivities? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, you can find recipes with and without alcohol from our guests at WPR.org. Look for the Central Time page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation about our favorite holiday cocktails with Carrie Jones and John McCarthy. Their new book is called Be Your Own Bartender, a surefire guide to finding and making your perfect cocktail. If you have a question about maybe some inspiration for something to make at your holiday get-together or to share your favorite thing to make, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, you opened the book with some technique advice, including how to shake and how to stir. And I thought, well, you know, stirring, that's easy. You just stir, but there's a right way to stir. Can you talk us through that?
Sure. When you're stirring, you want to have the back of your stirring spoon against the inside of your mixing glass or whatever you're using to mix in. And it's just a nice, easy motion. And you want to stir about 30 seconds is going to give you the right ice melt, the dilution. The most important ingredient in any cocktail is water. And it's going to chill it down to the right temperature for you.
So 30 seconds or more. See, and I probably do maybe 3 seconds at the absolute most. It really makes a difference?
It really makes a difference because you're going to get the ice melt, that dilution that you want, and you're going to chill the drink down. If you've ever been to a bar and you've had a drink that it just tastes too strong, stirred cocktails, because it hasn't been stirred long enough, really.
And Carrie, you two also write about gear, the kind of stuff you might want to have around to make drinks. Is there a thing that you see when you're watching other people make drinks, when you're making drinks on your own, that you're like, yeah, you got to have that in your lineup?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that jiggers are really the most important thing you can have. So the, you know, just to measure out the proper amount of liquid for your cocktails, you know, some people will do it with a tablespoon or with a shot glass, and those can work in a pinch, but you know, a good jigger only costs a few dollars, and it really just makes making cocktails so much easier. So that's one of the very first things that you should find if you're interested in cocktails.
All right, now let's get to the other recipe we have up at WPR.org on our Central Time page. John, you sent us a non-alcoholic cocktail that you made for Central Time here, so I got to try this one. I haven't yet. Tell us about the mistletoe.
All right, the mistletoe. Well, this is our everybody friendly. You can have one and get right in the car and be safe. Apple juice, quality apple juice like Martinelli's. We're using that 100% cranberry juice that we used in the Dickory Dock, and we're using that rosemary honey that we used in the Dickory Dock, and we're mixing those together with a little club soda to have a nice, wintry, refreshing cocktail. Non-alcoholic, of course.
Yeah, and this one sounds really good. Do you get a lot of requests as a mixologist, John, for non-alcoholic stuff, or do people know when they come in, hey, this is about the alcohol?
Oh, a lot of requests for non-alcoholic, and it's actually quite a trend these days in the bar scene that most places will have an actual menu of non-alcoholic drinks.
And Carrie, and maybe both of you can tackle this one. Sometimes I'm in a bar in Wisconsin, and it's a beer place or a shot place. If you ask for a drink with more than two ingredients, you get a little side eye. Carrie, do you have any advice on the best kind of cocktails you can get? Simple, they don't put too much work on the busy bartender.
I think the simpler the better. I will order a gin and tonic at any time of year, even though, you know, some people consider it a summer drink, but I still like the flavors of gin in the winter. So I would say don't do something more complicated than you think the bar can handle, because then no one's happy. The bartender's not happy, and you don't have a good drink. And there's nothing wrong with a shot in a beer if you want a shot in a beer.
And, John, you know, people have been making cocktails for decades, probably centuries. But are you still feeling like you're discovering new combinations and new things as a mixologist?
Oh, absolutely. Well, and especially, you know, someone comes to me and across the bar asks me a question that's never been asked before. And you kind of come up with something for them right then. But it's great because they're almost like templates. There have been so many drinks that have been made, but then there's ultimate variations that you can make on all these drinks.
And Carrie, I got to ask, you know, we've got a mixologist and a drink reviewer. You've got this cookbook or recipe book for drinks. Is there a lot of pressure when people are coming over to your place? They're expecting some really primo cocktails that you got to live up to.
Absolutely. That is the first thing we consider when we have people over or at our wedding or anything like that.
At our wedding.
Wait, you didn't have to bartend your own wedding, right?
Oh, thank God.
No, okay.
No, we got the friends to do that.
And can you leave us, John, with a pep talk for people who think, okay, you know, I'm all thumbs when it comes to making drinks, for taking that first step and making something fun this holiday season?
Yeah, it's the point is to have fun. You know, the point is to, if you can make a drink that you enjoy, then everybody else is going to enjoy it too. It's just, if you can take the pressure off yourself, make something fun, make something easy so you don't drive yourself crazy, and then just share it with your friends and family.
Sounds fantastic. Carrie and John, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
We're talking to Carrie Jones and John McCarthy. Their new book is called Be Your Own Bartender, a surefire guide to finding and making your perfect cocktail. You can find a couple of the recipes they shared with us on the Central Time page at WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Early estimates show that the number of people who died from a drug overdose in the U.S. last year totaled more than 72,000. According to the National Center for Health Statistics, nearly 68% of those involved opioids. That's more than a fourfold increase over the last decade and a half, and it's because of the scale and magnitude of the opioid crisis that some are looking at a less conventional method of treatment. One of those methods is called heroin-assisted treatment. Jonathan Calkins is a professor of operations research and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. He formerly co-directed RAND Corporation's Drug Policy Research Center. He's the co-author of a recent paper for RAND looking into the effectiveness of heroin-assisted treatment. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, talk us through how this heroin-assisted treatment might work for a particular patient in addiction treatment.
If you're familiar with methadone, in many respects, it's very similar. It's basically substituting the dangerous, impure, illegal opioids that you could purchase in a street market with medically supervised, pure opioids. In this case, it's heroin itself as opposed to a cousin molecule, but all those maintenance molecules operate on the same neuroreceptors in the brain.
And as I understand it, this generally wouldn't be viewed as the first line of defense. This isn't plan A. This is for the patients for whom methadone and those other options you talked about isn't working, right?
Yes, that's correct, in part because that's what's been researched in the past. And also, it's expensive, so you would try something like methadone first.
Where are people doing this around the world? Not here in the United States, but other countries, you write in this report, have been using this method.
Yeah, several countries in Europe and Canada.
And what kind of results are they seeing?
It stabilizes people's lives and reduces the amount of illegal heroin consumed and keeps people in treatment longer.
And that the risks of the illegal opioid seems to be a big part of the story here, where the person who's addicted getting these illegal drugs has no idea the potential dosage. It might be 100 times as strong tomorrow as the one they're taking today, right?
Absolutely, in part because it's often adulterated with fentanyl now. So the street heroin is more dangerous in the era of fentanyl than it was 5 or 6 years ago.
So we don't do this in the United States right now. What would it take to get from here where we're not using heroin for addiction treatment to where we are, to where we're at least piloting this?
So right now we could do a research pilot, but only that at this point, because heroin is listed under Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act, which is a schedule for all things that are not recognized as medicine. It'd have to get moved over to Schedule 2, as cocaine already is. Rescheduling a substance is an administrative process. It doesn't happen very often, but it can be done.
A lot of people might hear this and say, wait a minute, we want to get people off of heroin. This treatment just keeps them on heroin. Is the idea that, okay, once we've got them in the door with these maintenance treatments, we can also be trying other methods to ultimately, hopefully, end the addiction?
The short answer is yes, but in no rush. The downside of having someone drop out and go back to using street heroin, potentially injecting with dirty needles, is so great that you don't put a lot of time pressure on that transition.
I think a lot of people look at this as kind of a form of moral surrender, I guess, giving heroin to a heroin addict. What would you say to them about the public benefit, public health benefits of taking this approach?
Well, the public health benefits are clear. You're going to reduce the number of people who overdose, you're going to reduce the spread of blood-borne diseases like hepatitis and HIV, and you also reduce crime because you're taking away demand for the illegal market. I understand that this is a difficult idea to get your head around. Methadone was controversial when it was first introduced, and for parallel reasons. This exacerbates the irony because it's literally the same chemical that they were seeking in the street markets. But the logic is parallel to what it is with methadone. One thing that's important to realize is that heroin is a very peculiar drug. It can kill you in a moment. Very risky for overdose. It does not have long-term chronic effects on organs. It's like the opposite of tobacco cigarettes. Almost nobody dies of a tobacco cigarette overdose, but it's really bad to use it in the long run. And heroin is a peculiar thing, incredibly dangerous in the short term, does not cause long-term damage, chronic damage to organs from chronic use. It's a peculiar thing.
I've never heard it put exactly that way, so that puts the urgency of preventing that short-term impact, the overdose death, really front and center. That is job number one in a lot of ways if we don't have that risk from the chronic use.
Absolutely, and the flip side of that is the health harms of using for multiple years, if the stabilization takes a long time, are a lot smaller than you might imagine. They're not zero, and taking any opioid over an extended period can increase sensitivity to pain, for instance. So it's not great, but compared to dying and the risk of overdose death is very high, as we all know, in this era, as I said, with fentanyl making it much worse than it was even 5 years ago.
Talking to Jonathan Calkins from Carnegie Mellon University. He's the co-author of a recent paper for RAND looking into the effectiveness of heroin-assisted treatment. You also, in this report, you and your colleagues, Jonathan, looked at supervised usage centers for heroin. Now, how does that work? That's different than what we're talking about with this medically-based heroin treatment.
Yeah, it's completely different. These are rooms where somebody who has purchased an illegal drug can go and use it under supervision. So if they overdose, there's somebody there with naloxone or oxygen or can call 911. And also inside the facility, there are sterile injection equipment to eliminate the spread of blood-borne diseases.
And what do we know about the effectiveness there? Obviously, you don't have that quality control that you do from the prescribed heroin. You don't know what they're bringing in, right?
Correct.
So what in places that have tried this, what kind of results do we see in terms of effectiveness of preventing overdose deaths?
So there's never been an overdose death inside one of these supervised consumption sites. What's less clear, and it's just the nature of the research evidence and the absence of randomized control trials, is how big a beneficial effect they have on use that continues outside of the facility. Most people who use these facilities use them for only some of their use sessions, and it's hard to know for sure how big the impact is on whether or not they change their practices when they're using outside the facility too. But at least no overdoses inside the facility, and you also can connect the people with services. You can give them clean syringes. You can sometimes get them referred into treatment. So it can also be a hook into other services.
And you mentioned the lack of randomized controlled studies. It seems like that would be difficult to do for a lot of potential heroin addiction treatments. Is that does that make it more difficult to research the issue?
Yes. It's easier to do a rigorous study of an individual-level intervention, like heroin-assisted treatment, than it is the opening up of an entire facility. And the facilities have been opened up. Again, it's Canada and Europe primarily, but also Australia. They've been opened up in response to crises, not as part of a research program. That's why the evidence is favorable, but not as rigorous in a scientific sense as the evidence on heroin-assisted treatment, where it's very strong evidence.
Now, as someone who researches public policy, you and your colleagues have put out this paper, it seems, saying that there are these clear benefits, especially to this heroin-assisted treatment. Do you see this as something that policymakers in the United States would be willing to pursue?
I think there's a good chance. The opioid crisis is so horrific that I think it's important to be open-minded about trying things that we wouldn't have felt compelled to try before the overdoses exploded the way they have.
We'll leave it there for now. Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Jonathan Calkins, professor of operations research and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University. He's the co-author of the new report we've been talking about from the RAND Corporation, looking into heroin-assisted treatment and supervised injection sites aimed at helping avoid deaths from opioid overdoses.